In the crisp autumn of 1775, as 13 American colonies teetered on the precipice of rebellion, a British officer penned a telling observation. This Samuel Adams, evasive yet blunt, gracious yet inflexible, poor yet incorruptible, is the most dangerous man in Massachusetts. Indeed, while Washington commanded armies and Jefferson penned declarations, it was Samuel Adams who meticulously engineered the American Revolution through sheer force of will and political genius. Described by Thomas Jefferson as truly the man of the Revolution, Adams transformed from a failed businessman at age 41 into America's premier revolutionary strategist. His talent for manipulating public opinion, organizing resistance, and breathing life into democratic ideals made him both revered and reviled. Despite his pivotal role, Adams remains surprisingly obscure in popular history, partly by his own design, as he destroyed his papers to protect associates. While his cousin John Adams and Thomas Jefferson grew in stature after independence, Samuel began to shrink from view, falling out of the picture that would shape America's understanding of its founding moment. Today, his revolutionary brilliance is experiencing renewed appreciation among historians, who recognize him as the mastermind who calculated exactly what was needed to upend an empire. Samuel Adams seemed an unlikely revolutionary in his early years. Born in 1722 to a successful Boston maltster, young Samuel enjoyed a privileged upbringing in a stately harbor home complete with private wharf and orchard. At 13, he entered Boston Latin School before proceeding to Harvard, where he studied Euclid, Homer, and absorbed Enlightenment thinkers like Locke and Montesquieu. Unlike many Harvard students known for rebellious behavior, Adams's only recorded infraction was oversleeping. His postgraduate years proved directionless despite his excellent education. As one chronicler aptly summarized, he read theology and abandoned the ministry, read law and abandoned the bar, entered business and lost £1,000. Religion remained central to his thinking, a foundation for his later revolutionary ideas, as republicanism emerged as a secular, more relaxed form of Puritanism. For his master's degree in 1743, Adams chose the provocative thesis topic, "Is it lawful to resist the supreme magistrate if the republic cannot otherwise be preserved?" He answered affirmatively, arguing that while subjects must obey rulers who govern lawfully, they are discharged from all obedience when natural rights are imperiled, an early articulation of revolutionary principles. Though seemingly disconnected from his revolutionary future, Adams's early years revealed qualities that would define him: remarkable equanimity, immunity to flattery, rejection of social pretension, and inflexible principles. He was physically indefatigable, affable in manner, and drew people to him naturally. Though he never made a wise financial decision, believing poverty was not so disagreeable a companion, he passionately valued education as essential to a republic. Between Adams's undergraduate degree in 1740 and his master's in 1743, Massachusetts experienced dramatic economic decline. Trade decreased by half, industries fled to cheaper ports, unemployment rose, and population declined. The colony struggled with crushing taxes while facing an acute currency shortage. When Parliament extended the Bubble Act to declare the land bank illegal, a venture in which Adams's father had invested heavily, the family was financially ruined. The controversy raised fundamental questions about colonial governance. Who truly controlled Massachusetts? Its own House of Representatives or a distant parliament? This crisis established a pattern that would recur: a royal governor manufacturing disorder to elicit London's help, which arrived disproportionate to the actual crisis. The land bank controversy strangled the court system for years, with careers and family shipwrecked in the process. John Adams would later claim it caused greater ferment than the Stamp Act, while Samuel drew from it a lifelong conviction: "Let the people keep a watchful eye over the conduct of their rulers, for we are told that great men are not at all times wise." In March 1747, 24-year-old Adams accepted election as a Boston market clerk, a modest salaried position that aligned with his idealistic, gregarious nature. The role sent him into the bustling streets among bakers, butchers, and oystermen to ensure goods were fresh, properly weighted, and fairly priced. Adams essentially invented retail politics as he moved among the common people, firmly believing their opinions should never be neglected. Adams's political convictions hardened by his late 20s, shaped by his father's rejection from the Governor's Council and the events of 1747, when Admiral Charles Knowles attempted to forcibly recruit Bostonians to replace his deserting crew. The town erupted in riots, giving Adams his first taste of violent resistance and suggesting that detours around authority might prove both necessary and effective. With friends, Adams established the Independent Advertiser newspaper in January 1748, covering the Knowles tumult in its debut issue. Though professing no agenda, the paper's mission was to defend the liberties and rights of mankind and inspire New Englanders with a just and proper sense of their own condition. Adams's early writing style was already evident, calm, deliberative, precise, and unassailably logical, with long sentences and ardent semicolons, but without the exclamation points and capital letters favored by his contemporaries. In the Advertiser's columns, Adams found his enduring themes. Liberty was his anthem, a charming sound that mankind fought for with zeal. Yet he lamented that liberty was more often admired than understood, with men extolling it while meaning only their own well-being. Adams insisted on a crucial equation. A corrupt people could not remain free. He, therefore, is the truest friend to the liberty of his country who tries most to promote its virtue, he concluded. By 1764, Adams appeared to be shambling toward obscurity, a graying 41-year-old widower, inexpensively dressed, familiar with nearly everyone who crossed his path. He had held off his father's creditors, but his house was in disrepair. He had run the malt business into the ground. Charges of financial impropriety clung to him, yet he remained cheery and congenial. Though his hands had developed a quiver, his fortunes were about to change as events met him halfway. The House of Commons was on course to blast him from his aimlessness. In September 1763, British Prime Minister George Grenville sought ways to extract more revenue from the colonies, noting that Britain collected only 1,000 to 2,000 pounds while spending 7 or 8 times as much. With British debt ballooning from American wars, Parliament passed the Sugar Act in March 1764, halving the duty on molasses but strengthening enforcement. Adams drafted Massachusetts's official response, arguing that colonies were useful to Britain only if allowed to prosper. He questioned the logic behind the legislation. "For if our trade may be taxed, why not our lands?" and warned that taxation without representation reduced free subjects to the miserable state of tributary slaves. News of the Stamp Act reached Boston in May 1765, requiring tax stamps on everything from newspapers to playing cards, wills to diplomas. Parliament passed it not just to raise revenue, but to assert authority. While initial reaction was muted, Virginia's House of Burgesses soon declared that only Virginia had the right to tax Virginians, making Massachusetts blush at its own moderation. On August 14, 1765, Bostonians awoke to find an effigy of Andrew Oliver, the appointed stamp collector, hanging from an elm tree. The figure bore the message, "What greater glory can New England see than stamp men hanging from a tree?" Crowds gathered throughout the day, including schoolchildren brought to witness the spectacle. At dusk, the effigy was cut down, paraded past the governor's home, and taken to a building Oliver had erected, presumed to be a stamp office, which was quickly demolished. The mob then attacked Oliver's home, smashing windows and destroying furniture. Though Samuel Adams was never directly implicated in the riots, he was likely well informed through his connections with the disguised gentleman and street contacts. He downplayed the August 14 events, suggesting the crowd initially intended only an effigy hanging. Adams spent considerable time in smoky back rooms with tradesmen who were beginning to call themselves the Sons of Liberty. Instead of direct involvement, Adams focused his efforts at his desk, drafting political documents that would shape the resistance. In September 1765, Adams was elected to fill a vacant seat in the Massachusetts House of Representatives. He was immediately tasked with drafting Boston's instructions to its representatives, a document that affirmed the inherent, inalienable rights of the people while opposing the Stamp Act. When Governor Bernard addressed the reconvened House, suggesting they accept the Stamp Act despite its inexpediency, Adams drafted the fiery response. He chastised Bernard for not advocating for the colony and rejected the governor's warnings of general outlawry. Adams's political genius lay in his ability to coordinate resistance across social classes and geographic boundaries. Boston's opposition movement operated as an organic, overlapping network without a single mastermind or clear chain of command. Power shifted among social tiers, with different groups shading into one another. While Adams frequented multiple groups, the Sons of Liberty, Monday Night Club, and North End Club, no single person occupied the movement's center. Yet Adams knew precisely which back rooms to frequent, connecting men whose thinking converged under his influence, what his enemies termed his black art. After his election, Adams arranged for a gallery to be constructed in the House, allowing Massachusetts citizens to observe their representatives for the first time. This architectural change embodied Adams' view that government served its constituents rather than the reverse. With an audience present, representatives played to the crowd, making proceedings more democratic. Adams further democratized proceedings by publishing House deliberations, confirming Governor Bernard's fear that some were intent on bringing government nearer and nearer to the common people. Adams took the quarrel to paper with an army of pseudonyms. His wife Betsy fell asleep to the incessant motion of the pen in the next room, while neighbors passing after midnight saw the candlelit window where Samuel Adams was hard at work writing against the Tories. Through 1769, he adopted roughly one new pseudonym monthly, inhabiting characters from Vindex, a Roman governor who rebelled against Nero, to Candidus, a second-century Roman general. His 30-plus pseudonyms created the illusion of widespread dissent, allowing him to stretch truth, audition ideas, and speak as a one-man multitude. Adams ambushed language itself to alter colonial thinking. He renamed the townhouse the State House, transformed province laws into laws of the land, and slipped phrases like both countries into petitions. By the late 1760s, he'd redefined patriot to mean loyalty to American rights rather than the British Empire. He introduced a new political entity, the body of the people, which included even those without voting rights. Adams organized elaborate celebrations of the first Stamp Act riot, establishing August 14th as a day to commemorate American rights. The 1769 Jubilee featured 14 morning toasts, a feast of barbecued pig for 350 Sons of Liberty under streamers and sailcloth, and 45 afternoon toasts. These events, as John Adams noted, tinge the minds of the people. They impregnate them with the sentiments of liberty. On March 5, 1770, under a slim moon, tensions between Bostonians and British soldiers boiled over. A crowd gathered on King Street near the Customs House, pressing close to the redcoats, taunting them, "God damn you! Fire and be damned! We know you dare not!" As church bells tolled, Captain Preston assured a concerned citizen he had no intention to fire. Suddenly, a stick struck a grenadier, sending him sprawling across the ice. A shot rang out, followed by more musket fire. 5 men were wounded, 3 fatally, including a black sailor shot twice in the chest and a teenage ship's mate killed instantly. The morning after the shootings, Hutchinson convened his council with military officers present while doctors conducted autopsies across town. Boston selectmen demanded immediate troop removal, which Hutchinson claimed he lacked authority to order. Samuel Adams led a committee to confront the acting governor. When Hutchinson offered to withdraw only the 29th Regiment to Castle William, Adams returned to a town meeting of 3,000 to 4,000 citizens at Old South Church, who deemed this insufficient. In a second confrontation that afternoon, Adams delivered a forceful ultimatum. Both regiments must leave or face thousands of armed countrymen. With trembling knees and pale face, Hutchinson finally conceded, asking Colonel Dalrymple to remove both regiments. Adams immediately set about shaping how the events would be remembered, coining the term "horrid massacre" that would permanently define the incident. The town staged elaborate funerals for the victims, with bells tolling and thousands attending. Adams ensured the Boston Gazette portrayed Preston commanding his men to fire with gruesome results while sanitizing any crowd provocation. Paul Revere produced a dramatic hand-colored engraving showing soldiers firing in unison at unarmed civilians, with blood spurting from victims and a smoking musket in the Customs House window labeled Butcher's Hall. Just 5 days after the soldiers' trial ended with acquittals and minor convictions, Samuel Adams launched his own public retrial through 10 Vindex essays in the Boston Gazette. He systematically dismantled the court's verdict, questioning witness credibility, resurrecting sympathetic portraits of the victims, and asking pointed questions. Why weren't the soldiers in their barracks at 8 p.m.? How could Preston's alleged "don't fire" command be heard in battle? Could armed soldiers truly claim self-defense against civilians? Determined to shape history before it faded, Adams orchestrated elaborate March 5, 1771 commemorations. Church bells tolled at noon and after dark when thousands visited Paul Revere's illuminated triptych depicting Sider's ghost, soldiers firing on innocents, and liberty-capped America pinning down a grenadier. These annual commemorations would continue until 1783, when they yielded to July 4th celebrations. In 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act to rescue the financially troubled East India Company while incidentally reinforcing British sovereignty. They chose the worst possible commodity. Tea was already politically toxic in America, with many colonists refusing to serve or drink it as a matter of principle. And Boston was the least congenial destination, with the 6 appointed tea agents being Hutchinson's sons, relatives, and close friends. When the Dartmouth arrived with 114 chests of tea, Adams faced a critical deadline. The ship had 20 days to unload and pay duties before customs could impound the cargo. The committee met before and after Sabbath worship on November 28th, plastering the town with notices summoning every friend to his country to resist this most deleterious assault on American rights. Thousands gathered at Old South Church, where Adams explained he preferred to trust the public virtue of his countrymen in rejecting the tea rather than their private virtue in refraining from consuming it. On December 16th, with 14 hours remaining before the tea would legally belong to authorities, thousands gathered at Old South Church. After learning that both customs and naval boards had denied Roch's request to depart, the meeting dispatched him to appeal directly to Governor Hutchinson. At Milton, Hutchinson refused to grant an unprecedented exception, having sworn to uphold all acts of trade. When Roch returned with this news around 6 p.m., Adams, Young, and Quincy delivered speeches condemning tea. As the meeting began to disband, a small section silently detached itself from the west side of the room. War whoops and whistles soon sounded outside, and despite Adams' attempts to continue the meeting, the crowd dispersed. Meanwhile, a group of men disguised as Indians proceeded to the harbor, where they systematically destroyed 342 chests of tea in about 2 hours, working with remarkable precision and discipline. The morning after the tea party brought exhilaration to Boston. Samuel Adams reported with satisfaction the height of joy that sparkles in the eyes and animates the countenances of citizens, while noting the disappointed, disconcerted Hutchinson and his tools. In his communications to other Massachusetts towns, Adams carefully described the event without mentioning perpetrators, stating only that, in a very little time, the tea was immersed in the bay. When news reached Britain, it delivered an electrical shock. The king was incensed, and Benjamin Franklin became the first casualty, receiving a furious dressing down meant for Adams and losing his crown positions. The Massachusetts House attempted an audacious impeachment of Chief Justice Peter Oliver, presenting the papers to an empty chair when Hutchinson refused to be present. Hutchinson, exasperated by these Adams-designed technicalities, dissolved the House, though not before they locked their doors against his dissolution order. As Boston faced punishment through the Boston Port Act, Adams immediately mobilized resistance. He assembled the Boston Committee of Correspondence and dispatched Paul Revere with urgent letters to New York and Philadelphia, framing the crisis as an attack on all colonies' sacred rights and liberties. Adams warned that the port's blockade would leave Bostonians to perish from cold and hunger, and emphasized that even the most favored can only expect to be last devoured. As the Continental Congress approached, Adams prepared to leave Massachusetts for the first time at nearly 52 years old. Before his departure, a mysterious procession of benefactors arrived at his door, a tailor, hatter, shoemaker, providing him with a complete new wardrobe and funds for the journey. Their journey south became a triumphal procession through Connecticut, where bells pealed and crowds gathered to glimpse the obstreperous, rock-ribbed Massachusetts men. On September 5, 1773, the delegates gathered at City Tavern and walked to Carpenter's Hall, quickly agreeing on Virginia's Peyton Randolph as chairman and Charles Thompson as secretary. At 51, Adams was among the oldest and least prosperous delegates. Though notorious, he displayed remarkable restraint, becoming the most cautious, artful, and reserved of the New Englanders. He strategically faded into the background, allowing Virginians to take the lead while he worked tirelessly behind the scenes. When Thomas Cushing proposed opening with prayer despite denominational differences, Adams rose for his first speech, suggesting Episcopalian minister Jacob Duché, a calculated move to please both Virginians and New Yorkers. By April 1776, Adams finally began speaking the word independence aloud, finding the South and North aligned while the five middle colonies hesitated. "The child independence is now struggling for birth," he reported, as congressional moderates began losing their hold. When Richard Henry Lee introduced the resolution to dissolve all political connection with Great Britain on June 7, Adams delivered what colleagues considered his finest speech in support. Adams placed his modest signature on the Declaration of Independence, likely in August rather than July 4th. Though relieved, he remained convinced Canada would have joined had independence been declared in 1775. Critics claimed Adams boasted of having labored upwards of 20 years to accomplish the measure, though Benjamin Rush more accurately noted independence had been the first wish of his heart 7 years before the war began. Adams's later years proved challenging as the revolutionary movement gave way to nation-building. His talents for grievance sharpening served rebellion better than statesmanship. Even friends found him uncompromising. When Hancock departed Congress with pomp and a troop of light horse, Adams followed quietly days later, finding him already maligning him in Boston, nursing rumors of Adams's involvement in the Conway cabal against Washington, a conspiracy he knew little about. In summer 1780, Adams returned to Boston to help craft and ratify the state constitution, a document allowing majority rule while checking passions and whims. Days after ratification came news of Thomas Hutchinson's death in London. He died convinced Adams was most responsible for the revolution, a tribute Adams would have reversed. Adams struggled with the federal constitution, stumbling at the threshold of national rather than federal government. He insisted on a Bill of Rights, but withdrew it for compromise. In 1789, Hancock and Adams were elected governor and lieutenant governor of Massachusetts. Adams became a monument visited by French travelers and Venezuelan revolutionaries. When Washington visited Boston, Hancock made himself unavailable over protocol, leaving Washington to tour with the Adams cousins. Onlookers exclaimed, "Behold three men who can make a revolution when they please," and "the three genuine pivots of the revolution." Hancock died in 1793 at 56. Adams presided over his funeral until his strength gave out. He ascended to the governorship that October. His old nervous disorder left his head and hand shaking violently, halting his speech. In his inaugural address, he returned to Lockean ideals, liberty and equality, forming America's creed. Adams died on October 2, 1803, at 81, his family at his side. Bells tolled briefly, the funeral procession drew thousands but felt muted. Though hailed as the father of the American Revolution and the first to contemplate separation from Britain, he was promptly forgotten. Boston preferred to minimize the messy street protests, repackaging the Tea Party as a costumed caper decades later. The 4th of July consumed all revolutionary holidays, erasing Otis and Adams, their essays and innovations. Jefferson offered the most revealing tribute in 1800, resuming correspondence after years apart. "Your principles have been tested in the crucible of time and have come out pure," he wrote, confessing more affection for Adams than any other patriot. In his inaugural address after defeating John Adams, Jefferson channeled Samuel directly, asking himself repeatedly, "Is this exactly in the spirit of the patriarch of liberty, Samuel Adams?" Perhaps the most fitting epitaph for this revolutionary mastermind came from Thomas Jefferson, who called him the earliest, most active, and persevering man of the Revolution. Without Samuel Adams, the man who transformed colonial grievances into revolutionary action through sheer force of will, political genius, and unwavering principle, America as we know it might never have come to be.